Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast, Becca Explains the Occupation. I'm your host, Becca, and I am an Israeli educator on the occupation with a decade of experience examining how the complex realities of the occupation are playing out on the ground in real time. So in this podcast, we'll explore how political decisions and global trends and Israeli politics are shaping the ongoing occupation, especially in this moment. And we'll connect the dots between policies and their real-world impacts, principally on Palestinians, but also on Israelis. For this podcast, I'll be drawing on my background in education and as a political organizer in the West Bank. And I'll be breaking down the systems at play and offer insights into this multifaceted situation. So join me as we delve into the nuances of the occupation, its effects, and the broader context surrounding it. Thank you so much for joining. I've been getting a lot of questions on Instagram in my DMs of kind of like, where's the opposition? Or will there be a ceasefire and hostage release deal? Why is Gantz, who is in the opposition, voting with the coalition in terms of things like there will be no Palestinian state, right? Why did MK Ofer Kassif, member of Knesset Ofer Kassif, who is actually a Jewish politician, but in the Jewish Arab Communist Party, why was he recently kicked out of the Knesset for 6 months? And so I wanted to kind of gather all of these questions and try and put it into a framework that I think is really helpful when thinking about Israeli politics, and specifically in terms of the occupation and in terms of Palestinians. So I would say that there's a traditional view of thinking about Israeli politics, and it's kind of on this left-right spectrum where the right wing is thought of as being hawkish and based in security, and the left wing is thought of as being more pro-peace. That's a very standard way of thinking about it. And it is true that the occupation and the conflict are kind of the axis in which Israeli politics function, right? In the US, I would say the axis in which US politics functions is mainly based on economics. In Israel, it's mainly based on security, conflict, occupation, right? Now, at the same time, for the most part, politicians don't talk about the occupation. And Israeli society doesn't talk about the occupation. So that's not necessarily how these groups would self-identify, but that's the axis that we are talking about, right? The system in Israel is a parliamentary system. There are 120 seats in the Israeli parliament, and it's all one district. And so you vote as a citizen for one party, and then depending on how many votes that party gets, it will get a certain amount of seats in the Knesset, right? In the Israeli parliament. So it's different, for example, if you're American, it's very different than the American system in that you're voting for a party, you are not voting for a candidate. And you know who the list of candidates are, of course, ahead of time. And your party, once the elections are done, will either join the coalition, like will become part of the government, the ruling government, or it might become a part of the opposition. Any government in Israel needs, theoretically, 61 seats in order to make a government. It could technically, and there are examples of it working very temporarily with 60 seats, assuming that there's a few members of Knesset who are not voting with the opposition, right? Because if it's 60 versus 60, there's no coalition. So it's generally thought of as a left-right spectrum, right? And then you would have, for example, Ben-Gvir is kind of the most right-wing today, the most extreme. And in the left or on peace, you have the Arab parties, but you also have the Labor Party. You have the party like Meretz, which is not currently in the Knesset, but they usually are. And that's generally how people talk about Israeli politics. I want to offer a different lens, which is the way that we should be thinking of Israeli politics and how decisions are being made when it comes to the occupation, when it comes to the war in Gaza, when it comes to the conflict in general, is how do these political parties and how do these politicians view control between the river to the sea, right? Between the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. Now, currently, there's only one state between the river to the sea, and that's the state of Israel, right? And in addition to that, in addition to the democratic, or at least semi-democratic state of Israel, you also have occupied territory that Israel also controls. The West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem, right? When we're talking about the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem, Israel basically uses different types and different levels of controls over these areas and over Palestinians. In East Jerusalem, Israel has annexed it. Israel sees it as part of Israel. The international community generally does not. In the West Bank, there is a military control. Everyone agrees on this, including Israel, right? There's a military government in the West Bank. And in the Gaza Strip, the military government was canceled in 2005, but there is a lot of military control over Gaza, including before October 7th, right? Control over airspace, over most land crossings, though Egypt also was responsible for two land crossings, one for people, one for goods, the sea space, right? So there was a level of control over Gaza. Now, in addition to that, you have the Palestinian Authority and you have Hamas, but these groups are not sovereign, right? They do not have the responsibilities of a state. They do not have the self-determination of a state. The most important thing to understand in this is that there's only one group between the river of the sea to the river to the sea that has legitimate use of violence, right? Israel can use the military to defend itself, and that's considered legitimate. And Israel can also use the military to enter Ramallah, to enter Jenin, to enter Gaza City. And that's overwhelmingly also considered legitimate, definitely by Israel, but also for the most part by the international community, right? Even though the international community has now come out and said occupation is not legal, it's not legitimate, practically, we haven't seen a loss of support overwhelmingly on this, right? And when you look at international relations, a lot of the ways that in international relations we define a state is who is a legitimate means of violence, right? And so the answer here is Israel. And this is important. There is not currently a single thing that any Palestinian body, including the Palestinian Authority, can do if Israeli soldiers want to go into a random house in Ramallah in the middle of the night, right? Even if that family is totally innocent, right? And this happens all the time. The Israeli army goes into houses, not necessarily in Ramallah, but throughout the West Bank all the time, right? It might be to arrest someone, but it might also be to do a mock arrest. That's an arrest where you basically, you're practicing, you go through the whole entire arrest, and then you let the Palestinian go at the end. It might be because this house has a good view below, and there are Israeli troops below, right? And it might be just to make our presence felt, which is this kind of Israeli military term of, we don't want Palestinians to lift their heads up because the idea of the occupation is to maintain control and maintain order. And one of the ways we do that is to make sure that Palestinians are too afraid to basically react or resist, right? If that puts a Palestinian's life in danger, there is not a single use of violence that Palestinians could employ, including the Palestinian Authority, to protect those Palestinians in that house in Ramallah. That's the case in 2024. And that's been the case, by the way, since June 1967, since the beginning of the 1967 occupation, right? Why is this important? Because when we talk about looking at how regimes or how the Israeli political groups think, I would break it down into three specific camps. And the first camp, which has traditionally been the largest camp, though it's shrinking, is the status quo camp. And the status quo camp more or less believes the only sovereignty that can exist between the river to the sea is the state of Israel. Right? Palestinians can potentially have limited authority, like they do with the Palestinian Authority, or they even did with Hamas in Gaza up until October 7th, right? On one hand, a lot of times the Israeli government said talked about Hamas as an enemy, and to an extent, rightfully so, of course. We saw that very clearly on October 7th. But to another extent, the Israeli government allowed Hamas to exist, facilitated money getting to Hamas, right? That was part of Netanyahu's policies. And so the main idea of the status quo camp is we believe there can be one state between the river to the sea that has a legitimate use of violence. That includes offensive violence and defensive violence. Yeah. Netanyahu traditionally is in this camp. Lapid traditionally is in this camp. The Labor Party traditionally is in this camp. Gantz traditionally is in this camp, right? The vast majority of politicians over the course of Israel's history and the 1967 occupation have been in this camp, with some exceptions. For example, during the Oslo period in the 1990s, to an extent in 2006 during talks. But even then, the vast majority of talks did not talk about the state of Palestine having use of weapons, having use of defensive weapons, having an army, right? It's what Netanyahu calls a state minus, a little bit less than a state, right? The next camp, and this is the largest growing camp, is the annexation camp. And that camp says, we want to annex the West Bank. Some people in this camp, some politicians say, we want to annex the whole of the West Bank. Some say, we only want to annex parts of the West Bank, like the Jordan Valley, which is the eastern strip of the West Bank. And now that we are over a year into the war with Gaza, of course, you have those who are talking about also annexing the Gaza Strip, such as Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, and different groups or different people within their political parties, particularly. Okay. And the third camp, which is the smallest camp, is the equality camp. And the equality camp basically says we believe in equality between the river to the sea, right? Equality between the river to the sea is the main function of the equality camp. It means equal individual and collective rights for Israelis and Palestinians, right? And I'll add here that we're talking about various political frameworks, right? If you're talking about Balad, they're talking more about a one-state solution. If you're talking about Hadash, Balad is an Arab party. If you are talking about Hadash, which is the Arab Jewish Communist Party, they're talking about a two-state solution. They're not a Zionist party, but they believe in the two-state solution. If you're talking about Meretz traditionally, they were also talking about a two-state solution. Right. Today it's mainly Arab parties. The political party Meretz is not currently in the Knesset. And I think that, I'll say this, and I think there are probably people listening who are saying, how could you possibly say that they're part of the equality camp? But there's two members of the Knesset, Naamah Lazimi and Gilad Kariv, where I would put them somewhere in between the status quo camp and the equality camp, right? If they're in the equality camp, then they certainly make a lot of, they give up on a lot of fights right now in the Knesset that would push the equality camp forward, yeah? But there's also other things that they have done that have kind of shown their desire to be part of the equality camp, or they show that they believe in equal rights between the river to the sea. One thing that's really interesting is that today you have Yair Golan, and he is the head of the Democratic Party, or the Democrats, I think they're called. They're a new party, and they're a combination of the Labor Party and Meretz. Meretz isn't even in the Knesset right now, and Yair Golan's not also not in the Knesset. He was just voted into this position. He seemingly should be part of the equality camp. And a lot of liberal Zionists see him as being part of the equality camp. He's certainly part of the peace camp, right? But I call it the equality camp because it's not exactly the same, right? Peace doesn't inherently necessarily mean equal rights for all between the river to the sea. His platform says, yes, we should get rid of settlements in the West Bank, but we're going to maintain military occupation over the West Bank and the right to military activity in Gaza, right? He also called, by the way, to occupy southern Lebanon, right? So he'll, on one hand, he's saying, let's get rid of settlements, right? That's certainly a step in the direction of the of what many people view in the equality camp as a right step. Could potentially have a result in which settlements stay, but there's some just solution for them, right? But that's generally considered kind of going in that direction. But on the other hand, he basically says, I want the ability for the Israeli military to be able to take over someone's house in Ramallah whenever we want. And that puts him firmly in the status quo camp. And that's what I think is really important to understand, is that if people in the Knesset right now could hear me putting some of these political parties together and saying, how can you say that we're similar, right? People would be up in arms. But when it really comes down to it, what's the essence of what we're talking about? Do you believe that there's space for shared power between the river to the sea? Do you believe there's space for equality? Or don't you? Right? And if we look at the current breakdown of the coalition and opposition of the current Israeli Knesset, which was voted in December of 2022, you have the Likud, which Benjamin Netanyahu is the head of, and they have 32 seats. And the Likud is somewhere between annexation and status quo. There are people inside the Likud today who are clear pro-annexation, such as Shikli. Netanyahu himself, I would say, traditionally is much more status quo. Netanyahu doesn't necessarily care to annex the West Bank. He certainly doesn't care to annex Gaza, right? However, because he cannot have a coalition without politicians from the annexation camp, he's constantly being pushed to the right. And over time, this has made his stances more pro-annexation. And I think his actions are more interesting than his words, right? And so, for example, in the 2019 elections, there were a series of elections between 2018 and 2021, or 2018 and 2020. In the second of those elections, Benjamin Netanyahu says, if I'm elected, we will annex the Jordan Valley of the West Bank, right? It's only part of the West Bank, but that's still a pro-annexation position. So you have people in the Likud who are a bit between annexation and status quo, but overwhelmingly the party is moving towards becoming an annexation party. They weren't there 20 years ago. We're seeing a lot of movement here. Then you have the Religious Zionist Party with Bezalel Smotrich. He has 14 seats. That includes also Ben-Gvir's party, Jewish Power. And it also includes Noam, which is an anti-LGBTQ party, and they have one seat. And they are a clear annexation party. They believe in annexing. And then you have, I'm going to get this wrong in English, United Torah Judaism with Moshe Gafni. It is an ultra-Orthodox party. He has seven seats. And together with Shas, which is a Sephardic ultra-Orthodox party led by Aryeh Deri with 11 seats, I would actually put them in status quo. They're not anti-annexation, but they're also not running towards policy that is incredibly pro-annexation. And I think a lot of times, again, if you were to look, a lot of people would put, when thinking about Israeli politics, would put the ultra-Orthodox at the most right-wing. And there are things that they are the most right-wing on, right? When it comes to perhaps rights to use technology on Shabbat, like to use buses on Saturdays. And when it comes to gender discrimination or to separating between men and women in public spaces, they're absolutely on the right. But when it comes to how the Knesset is generally actually forming around, they're fairly status quo. And then you have New Hope, which is led by Gideon Saar. He has four seats, and New Hope ran in these elections with the National Unity Party, which is led by Benny Gantz, and just recently left National Unity and joined the coalition. And he's annexation. Gideon Saar and his party is an annexation camp. Gideon Saar left the Likud. We'll get into that in a second, right? And so you have a mix of annexation and status quo, but it goes towards annexation. But also in the opposition, you have parties and people who are somewhere in between annexation and status quo. National Unity by Benny Gantz. Benny Gantz, he ran against Netanyahu in that 2019 election where Netanyahu says, if I'm elected, I will annex the Jordan Valley of the West Bank. And what does Benny Gantz say? Me too. I'll do the same, right? But you have other people in his party who are status quo. And more so than Netanyahu's party, you will hear Benny Gantz come out and speak out against settler violence. We'll talk more about how that looks actually on the ground. And then you have Yesh Atid, Yair Lapid, with 24 seats. He's the head of the opposition, and he is much more status quo, right? We'll get into him and his policies a little bit more. Yisrael Beiteinu by Avigdor Lieberman has six seats, and he is very much pro-annexation. Lieberman, I think, is actually an interesting party here, a person in this, because if I could add another axis to this, I would say even more so than being pro-annexation, Lieberman is racist. Meaning, Smotrich is talking about annexation because he wants West Bank land, and Lieberman and also Ben-Gvir's main motivation is anti-Arab racism, much more than it is specifically annexation. They're not really differentiating between Arabs here and Arabs there. Arabs who are citizens of Israel and Arabs, Palestinians in the West Bank or in Gaza, right? Not saying they look at them exactly the same, but the policies on them are much more motivated by racism. Lieberman in 2015 suggested that Palestinian citizens of Israel should take loyalty tests in order to maintain their citizenship, right? Inside the country. But we put him on the annexation camp. And then you have Labor, led by Merav Mikhaeli. That's now starting to be led by Yair Golan. And again, that's very much status quo. And then right now, you only have two Arab parties in the Knesset. One is the Arab Jewish Party Hadash, together with Tal. There are two parties in one. And the other is Ram. And they're not really a part of the opposition officially. And they both kind of represent the equality camps, meaning they want equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel, for their constituents who are voting for them. And they want equality for Palestinians in occupied territory. So if all of them more or less agree, except for the Arab parties today, that there should only be one state that has control between the river to the sea, that has sovereignty between the river to the sea, what are the differences? Like, why is not everyone joining the coalition? And so there's a few things. And I think looking at the past two coalitions show this really well. The first is there's some differences in social issues, right? There's no question that the Labour Party differences from the ultra-Orthodox Party in terms of things like LGBTQ rights, in terms of women's rights. They're much more socialist than some of the other parties, than the Likud party, for example. That's a difference. And if you talk to activists of these parties, they're big differences. The other is religious influence. You have, for example, Lieberman, who is incredibly right-wing, is racist, right? He's incredibly secular. He, in the past few governments, has basically been unwilling to sit with ultra-Orthodox parties, right? And the big fight right now that's happening, both within the coalition and between the opposition and coalition, but also even within the coalition, is the fact that ultra-Orthodox do not enlist into the army, right? They're not required to enlist into the army. And of course, because there's over 13 months of fighting at this point, the Israeli military is running out of human resources. They don't have enough soldiers to keep it all going. And so this has become a huge problem. And so Lieberman has basically said, I don't want to sit with ultra-Orthodox, right? In other words, we're almost seeing a reality in which it's so right-wing that there is now a fight over how to be right-wing. The best example of this is personal opposition to Netanyahu, right? Lapid at this point has personal opposition to Netanyahu for good reasons. He's corrupt. Lieberman has personal opposition to Netanyahu because he feels he's been burned by him before politically. Gideon Saar, who just joined the coalition, but for over a year was in the opposition, created his party New Hope as basically a parallel to the Likud party for members of the Likud who do not want to vote for Netanyahu because he's corrupt, right? But there's no policy differences between them. Not really, not in a meaningful way, right? And the last thing that I would say is relevant to bring in here is some willingness to talk in about political talks and to talk about Palestinians having some sort of state minus, right? Having some sort of autonomy. Lapid is willing to talk about that. Labor is willing to talk about that. That's fundamentally different than the equality camp, which says that's not enough, right? Autonomy is not enough. We want equality. But that's a difference, at least currently. So what are the similarities is that they agree that there can only really be one state between the river to the sea. Palestinians don't have a right to self-defense. There'll never be a Palestinian army, right? That's in every single proposal that's been made. Lapid just a few days ago came out with a new proposal for ending the war in Gaza. And he says, we're going to end the war in Gaza. We'll bring in the Palestinian Authority to Gaza, but they can only have civil administration there. No guns. And in the West Bank, we're going to reform the Palestinian Authority so that they stop supporting Palestinian terror, which is one of the biggest critiques of the Palestinian Authority from within Israel, right? Now, if you talk to the Palestinian Authority, or more importantly, if you talk to Palestinians, I think, in the West Bank, and I don't want to talk for them, but the main critique you hear about the Palestinian Authority is that they exclusively work with the Israeli occupation, right? The Palestinian Authority, on one hand, has a police force, can arrest Palestinians in Ramallah, but it can't do anything to stop settler violence. It can't do anything to stop Israeli military raids, right? It can't do anything to stop Israeli settlers from encroaching and taking land and nationalizing their land, right? For Palestinians, the Palestinian Authority is considered both incredibly weak and very much a partner to the Israeli occupation. What Lapid is offering is we're going to bring in the Palestinian Authority. We're going to reform them so they work better with us, right? So Lapid is offering an end to the war, but he's offering an end to the war that brings us back to the status quo, right? And that's what many groups are offering right now on the opposition. Labor is for that. Gantz, I think, would agree with that. There are groups that would agree with that, and I think that's a relevant and important thing to do in the sense that we want the fighting to stop in Gaza. We want the massacres to stop. We want hostages to come home. But it's bringing us back to the status quo more so than it's pushing us forward into a state solution, right? And this is where I think the status quo camp doesn't necessarily have that much to offer, because they're also not necessarily trying to get to a point where there's an independent Palestinian state. And Arab countries such as Saudi Arabia are saying, we're willing to come in and help only if it leads to the formation of a Palestinian state, right? And so these things are inherently at odds with each other. And the other thing, and I think this is really important, and it brings me to my last point, is that there's a general exclusion of Arab parties from both the coalition and the opposition. There's not really a willingness of either parties to work together with independent Arab parties. And today you only have 10 members of parliament out of 120. So I'm doing this math in my head and it might be a little bit off, but let's say that's about 8% of representation, right? These parties, these two parties together, three parties together represent 8% of the population. How many Arab citizens of Israel are there? 20%. We're missing at the very least 12% of representation. And then, of course, you have Jewish Israelis who also believe in equality. So they're also, their representation also is missing, right? It should be, I would say, somewhere between, you know, at least 25%. It's at 8%. And this is where I think it's really important to understand why the status quo camp and the annexation camp in some ways are so similar, because in the end, they both believe that there can only be one state between the river to the sea, and that state inherently has to be Jewish, right? There's this idea, it's actually a scientific idea, but it's used often in political science, called the purpose of a system is what it does, right? So if you build a system and you say the purpose of the system is to create chocolate ice cream, but this system that you built, this machine that you built, doesn't make chocolate ice cream, it makes vanilla yogurt. And over time, it continues to make vanilla yogurt. You can't really claim that the purpose of that system is to make chocolate ice cream, right? It's a basic concept. In Israel, in the parliament, I would argue that the system is created in such a way that the equality camp can never actually fully represent the amount of people who are part of the camp, right? And also, because it can't represent them, it can never grow. Meaning, pushing the equality camp to the side is part of the purpose of the system. And if we look back historically, I generally talk about the 1967 occupation, and that's also what this talk focuses on. But I actually think it's really important to jump back to the founding of the state in 1948. And between 1949 and 1966, there was martial law over Arab citizens in Israel. Jewish Israeli citizens were under full democracy, with freedom of movement, could vote, could participate politically, and just lived lives like anyone would in a functioning democratic society. Palestinian citizens of Israel, Arab citizens of Israel, were inherently considered to be an enemy. And so the government utilized martial law on Arab citizens of Israel until 1966. Now, first of all, this meant it decided who could even participate in elections. They could vote, but who could participate in elections? It also decided how often or in what way, or if at all, Palestinian political parties or movements could meet in order to organize politically, right? You can't have a strong political party if you can't organize yourself and your base. But what I think is the most classic example during this time is that there was actually Arab satellite parties to the Labor Party. The Labor Party was the ruling party, and it basically chose Arab political parties, and it chose the representatives in those parties and would have them run. And they were satellite parties because they basically were required more or less to vote together with the Labor Party. And so they were in the Knesset, they did exist, but they weren't necessarily able to vote for their interests. I think the best example of this is that in 1963, a vote comes to the Knesset to get rid of martial law for Arab citizens. And the vote failed by one vote. Two of the votes that voted against it, that voted to keep martial law, were Arab politicians who were voting with the Labour Party who wanted to keep martial law going. Right? Meaning two Arab politicians voted against their own constituents to continue on their constituents and on themselves martial law, which then continued for another 3 years. In 1966, the martial law was taken away, and 6 months later, the 1967 occupation starts. And of course, since then, Palestinians who are in Gaza, who are in the West Bank, are under Israeli military control. The type of control and the level of control has changed over the years, but Israel is the sovereign. But of course, they don't have political rights. And also, in the beginning of the state, you have the delegitimization of the one party that was a genuine independent Arab Jewish party voting for equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel, even before the 1967 occupation. And they were called Maki. And Ben Gurion, who was the first prime minister of Israel, famously said, without Herut and without Maki. Herut, meaning freedom, was the ultra-right wing political party led by Begin. And Maki was J the Jewish Arab Communist Party, right? And so Ben Gurion's ideas was, we don't want the radicals from both sides. We don't want the extremists from both sides, how he saw it, right? Over time, not only has Herut, has Begin, has what basically the Likud become the center of Israeli politics. And so he lost on that side, but there's also been kind of a solidification of the idea of Arab parties are not a part of Israeli coalitions and even aren't a real part of oppositions, right? And so if we jump to right now, I want to give a few examples. In 2014, Lieberman, right, same guy that we've mentioned a few times now, he wanted to increase the threshold, the amount of votes needed in, or the percentage of votes needed in order to get into the Knesset. And so now, instead of needing two seats to get into the Knesset, as of early 2015, you need 3.25% of the vote. And that buys you four Knesset seats, right? So the threshold, the amount of people voting for you, was increased fairly dramatically. The stated purpose for this was to basically weed out the smaller Arab parties and to take away their power, right? To take away their representation. In 2015, the Arab parties responded to this. The four Arab parties, they are called Balad, Tal, Hadash, and Ram, by creating one party that they called the Joint Arab List. It's called the Joint Arab List, despite the fact that one of the parties, Hadash, is Arab Jewish. And they became the third largest party in the Knesset, right? But they still weren't invited into talks in the opposition. They weren't a part, an active part of the opposition. It's important to say also, not all the Arab parties necessarily want to be a part of the conversation, right? But the reality is, it's a threshold that's not really passed. In 2022, though, you have the change government. And the change government, sorry, from 2021, and the change government, for the first time, invites a Arab party into the coalition, Ram. And it's really interesting because Ram is a conservative Bedouin party, like mainly representing Bedouin constituents in the Negev Nakab, in the southern part of Israel. The change government, this government without Netanyahu, it was led by Yair Lapid and Naftali Bennett, could not form without the inclusion of at least one Arab party. Right? Now, Ram is, I think, really interesting because of all the Arab parties, they're the most socially conservative. They're like a branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, right? But basically what Ram says is, we'll join your coalition. And to an extent, we'll even give up our fight for full equality, right? We'll put the nationalist question on the side. That was the demand. That was the way in which they could join. But we want resources for our communities. We want an end, or at least a huge kind of change in the policy of demolishing unrecognized Bedouin homes in the Negev, right? We're basically willing to put the nationalist question aside for civilian output, right? For good civilian outcomes for our constituents. And so the change government lasts a year. It has some people from the equality camp, Ram, but also you have a few members of Meretz, such as Gabi Lasky, who's a very well-known human rights lawyer on the issue of occupation. And they say, we'll join this government, but they're joining the government not only with politicians who are in the status quo camp, like Lapid and Gantz and Labor, but also with the annexation camp, specifically Yamina at the time, led by Naftali Bennett. Naftali Bennett is a leader of the settlement movement. He's not the most extreme leader of the settlement movement, but he's a leader of the settlement. He's in the annexation camp firmly with both of his feet, right? And so the question is, well, what happens in the change government? And if you look at the change government in terms of social issues, there is inside the country, you absolutely see some improvement. You see more subsidies to, to important health issues, public health issues. You see more women's rights. You see more LGBTQ rights. Yeah, you do see improvements in some of these social issues, but when it comes to the occupation, there's no fundamental change to the power structure, right? The government is still building settlements. The government even declares six Palestinian human rights organizations terror organizations. The six major Palestinian human rights organizations are declared terror organizations during the change government by Gantz, who's status quo, who at the time is the Minister of Defense, right? And because of this, a bunch of European countries in the US stop supporting these human rights organizations. And then they look in to see what are all of the reasons. Why did you declare them terror organizations? And they couldn't find anything. Like the worst accusations there are these organizations taught kids dabkeh, which is like a traditional Palestinian dance, right? But of course, what are these organizations doing? They're resisting the occupation. They're not resisting it violently. And some of the people who are in these organizations were once part of violent movements, but they've since stepped away from that and gone to human rights instead, right? There's basically no proof that any of these organizations were doing terror activity. And fairly slowly, after a few months, almost all the European governments went back to funding them because there is no proof. But this is what the change government brought. They built settlements. They tried to get rid of civil society in the West Bank, in Palestine in general, right? And in the end, the thing that kills this government, the thing that makes this government disband, and there's a few steps to it. You have an MK who's in Meretz, an Arab MK in Meretz, which is the most left Zionist party, leave the government because of the policies on Palestinians under occupied territory. She comes back after a few days, but she leaves. And you also have the annexation right camp in Yamina leaving because they feel that those in the equality camp are trying to put too much pressure on the party. What ends up falling this government is that in the West Bank, you have Israeli settlers who live there, right? And they live under Israeli civil law. And that's basically emergency regulations that allow them, according to Israeli law, it's illegal in international law, that allows them to live in the West Bank, which is not a part of Israel under Israeli civil law. And those regulations, because they're emergency regulations, they have to be renewed by the Knesset every so often. The opposition, being led by Netanyahu at this moment, is saying, we're not going to vote with a coalition on anything. We want them to fail. And the coalition doesn't have enough votes to pass through these regulations to keep the occupation going, to keep settlements functioning, right? And so they decide to break up the government because then these regulations automatically, no one needs to vote on them, they automatically are elongated. And so this change government that people said it will be the change for Israel, it will change the society, it will change the situation, broke down in order to continue the occupation functioning. And this is why I think it's so important when we talk about opposition and coalition, that what we're really talking about is, well, where are the government's views on the occupation and on control? Because that's what's actually pushing the government forward to one way or another. This current government that exists, that was signed between Netanyahu and Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, opens up by saying the sole sovereign in the land of Israel is the Israeli government, and that includes, of course, the West Bank, right? They say Judea and Samaria, but they're talking about the West Bank. But even if we look at the opposition, right, because that's the question, well, where's the opposition in all of this when it comes to trying to end the war, when it try come coming to try and end the occupation? Well, in July of 2024, you had some of the opposition supporting, Gantz supporting the resolution against a Palestinian state. Lapid's party and the Labour Party walked out and they abstained, right? So they didn't vote to say there can never be a Palestinian state, but they also didn't really make a fuss about it, right? Maintain the status quo. Lapid's war proposal we talked about l limits, let's end the war. We'll bring the PA, the Palestinian Authority, back in, but they can only have civil power in Gaza and in the West Bank. There's an overwhelming support for ground invasion entering Lebanon before it started. And even just now, Lapid, about a week ago, wrote on Facebook saying that he supports a new measure to kick out Arab Israeli citizens, to deny them their citizenship, to take away their citizenship. If their families are accused of acts of terror, which is an inherently undemocratic law, and also supported freezing Ofer Kasif from the Jewish Arab Party. He was basically kicked out of Knesset for 6 months for supporting South Africa's case in the International Court of Justice. And Lapid says, I support kicking out Kasif. But I think we need to do it the right way. I'm not sure we did it the right way, but fundamentally, I support. Right? And so this is where the opposition is. Again, I don't want to say there's no nuances between them, but when we break down these nuances and we get to the bare of the bone, the opposition is not opposing the occupation, and the opposition is not necessarily even really opposing the war. I really recommend going back and listening to a New York Times interview that was done with Yair Lapid months ago about the war. And the only thing that he really comes up with that he opposes in terms of what's going on in Gaza, despite the massacres, despite the starvation, right? Despite the clear indiscriminate killings that are happening at time, despite the fact that northern Gaza at that point had already been carpet bombed. And he said, the thing that I really oppose in terms of Netanyahu is we're not coming out and talking about how much we're caring for civilian life and following the law because Netanyahu doesn't want to upset those to the right of him. He doesn't want to upset Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, right? Meaning inherently, Lapid does not believe that any of the actual actions taken in this war by the government and by the military are immoral. Forget for a second if they're legal, are immoral. Right? Just a few days ago, the ICC came out with arrest warrants for Gantz and for Netanyahu. And of course, they haven't been tried yet. They're not yet guilty in a court of law, but there's clear, a clear case for starvation and ethnic cleansing in northern Gaza at the least. Right? And Lapid and Gantz and Yair Golan are all coming out against the ICC, meaning first and foremost, maintaining state apparatus is much, much more important. The last thing I'll say on this is, so the system is designed to maintain a one-state reality. It's designed to keep the equality camp small. And in that, a lot of people say we need to remove Netanyahu. And I agree that we need to remove Netanyahu because dude's corrupt. But that in and of itself is not necessarily going to make the larger picture more just. And with the current government as it stands, even if we were to rearrange things, the path to equal rights at this moment is unlikely to come from within the Israeli Knesset. And this is why the role of the international community is so important. We're not going to wake up one day and move from the status quo that we've been in for years and say, okay, we actually are all part of the equality camp. We're getting more people. The equality camp, I think, in actual numbers is growing, not in representation in the Knesset, but in actual numbers is growing. But so is the annexation camp, because the status quo is actually very unstable, right? The ability for Israel to actually maintain control over millions of Palestinians without having that violence be felt on ourselves is most likely behind us at this point. It's been maintained for a very long amount. And so, when we're thinking about, when you're asking yourself, why did the opposition vote against a Palestinian state? Some of the opposition, some abstained. Why did they vote to, or why did they support kicking out Ofer Kasif? Why are they not putting on more pressure to end the war? Even though many of them genuinely want the war to end, Gantz wants the war to end. Eisenkot lost his son and two nephews in the war. He wants the war to end, right? But because the next step of what they have to offer is not necessarily a very clear-cut, genuine solution that brings us to a new political place, what the right has to offer is ethnic cleansing, right? Is continued war, is continued occupation, is apartheid. But that, for many people, still sounds like more of a solution than trying to pretend like we can stay the same. And so I hope that this was a helpful framing in terms of thinking about how to look at Israeli politics and getting an understanding of where is the opposition, what is it opposing, and what is it not opposing. And what it's not opposing is the occupation and the maintained control between the river to the sea exclusively. Thanks so much for joining this episode, and I hope that it gave some insights for how to think about the Israeli political system in terms of the occupation and Palestinians and getting to a new political reality in which there is equality between the river to the sea. If you found this interesting and are able, you're very welcome to support at BuyMeACoffee/BeccaExplains. I'm always super appreciative, and thank you so much to everyone who has supported up until now. But also, the most important way to support is to pass this on to people who you think it will find interesting. And I will be seeing you next month. Next month, I'm going to be interviewing my friend Ali Awad. He is a resident of Masaf El Yatta in the South Hebron Hills, and he's going to be talking with us a little bit about how he experiences life in the South Hebron Hills since the day he was born, and especially in the past year. Thanks for joining.